Good afternoon. I'm Wyatt Orme, and this is Aspen Public Radio's rebroadcast of an earlier session from the Aspen Institute, The Influence of Housing on Health. Support for this broadcast of the Ideas Festival comes from Obermeyer Wood Investment Council, an independent investment advisor committed to helping clients navigate life's financial decisions. Learn more about the firm's team and approach at obermeyerwood.com.
So, hello, good morning, everybody. I'm Mark Henderson from the Wellcome Trust. We're the world's second largest philanthropic foundation dedicated to improving health. And when I was offered the chance to introduce a session here at Aspen, this one on housing and health was one that immediately sprang to mind as something that I was very keen for us to show our support for, because it's such a critical and important issue. Those of you who were here for the last session in this room about philanthropy will have heard my colleague Howard Frumkin talking about the links between the environment and health, which is a major priority for Wellcome, and the built environment, the housing that we live in, that we spend more time in than any other kind of building, is an absolute integral and critical part of that, both in the way that it shapes our personal health, but also public health and environmental health as well. We won't be able to tackle issues like climate change and their health impact without thinking clearly about how we live and the homes and houses that we live in. So nothing more from me, just to say I'm really looking forward to this session, and over to the panel. Thank you.
Hey, what's up, everybody? What's up? How many of you just got here yesterday? So you're all feeling like I am, which is that you took some water this morning and then you were like, okay, I think I'm gonna survive. Then you had some more and you were like, okay. And you had some Advil and you were like, okay, I'm gonna make it through the day. It's so great to be here, and I'm so thrilled to be moderating this conversation about an issue that we don't often think about, right? Oh, I'm sorry, my name is Maria Hinojosa. I'm the president and founder of Futuro Media. I am the anchor and executive producer of Latino USA on NPR, which has been 26 years, and In the Thick, which is a politics podcast that I permit you now to take out your phones and subscribe to both of them, Latino USA and In the Thick. And I'm so thrilled to be here to have this conversation with some pretty amazing people. Richard Besser, Dr. Richard Besser, is the president of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and a former colleague as a journalist on television. So, whoops, time to censor, so be quiet. And really, we're here because of Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. So I don't know, a round of applause for Dr. Richards. I mean, I'm just saying, credit where credit is due. John Giles is the mayor of Mesa, Arizona. So welcome, John. And Shirley Franklin is the former mayor of Atlanta. We were just looking at each other and we were like, wait, we know each other. I was interviewing her when she was the mayor of Atlanta several years ago. And now she is with Purpose Built Communities. So what we're gonna talk about is this thing that we often don't think about. I mean, we think about where we live. If you're a New Yorker, you're obsessed with real estate. So we think about this all the time. We're thinking about gentrification, a lot of us. I remember last time when I was at Aspen and I finally made it down and was doing the trails and looking up at the homes. And I was like, God, extraordinary homes, but who built them? Who built them, these modern homes? These immigrant laborers who may be invisible, and where do they go home to after they spend their days building these extraordinary houses? So I'm really thankful that Dr. Besser and that the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation has decided that they want to really jump in. And so I know that we had a prescribed first question, but I'm actually going to ask you this first, Rich, if it's okay if I call you that. I mean, why? Why housing when Robert Wood Johnson, I mean, you do a lot of things, but this is one of your priorities. What was it that made you say, no, we're going to focus on this and have this conversation?
That's a great question, and there's so many different ways to come at that. The way I like to think about it and get into it is really from my perspective as a general pediatrician. I still see children a half day a week in clinic. And from the beginning of my training, where people lived, whether they had access to a safe, affordable home, impacted their health. I remember in Baltimore as a resident, seeing children come in with lead poisoning. We would actually do an x-ray and we could see the paint chips in their bellies. And we would know that that could lead to permanent brain damage. And then in all of my years in New York working in a federally qualified health center, I remember this mom whose child had severe asthma. And we did some allergy testing and he was allergic to dust mites. Well, it's easy. You just clean up the apartment or the house, you remediate, and you take care of that. Well, that family lived in an apartment where the landlord didn't care, didn't want to invest, didn't want to get rid of the dust mites. And so because of that, we were dealing with bad housing with a breathing treatment and trips to the emergency room. So there's that human side of it. And then there's the work at the foundation. We're focused on a culture of health, which is a recognition that health takes place where we live, where we work, where our children study and learn, and where they play. And so much is dependent on where your house is located. You know, what community you happen to be born into will define it. In Princeton, where our foundation is located, the life expectancy of a child born there is 88 years. In Trenton, same county, 14 miles down the road where I see children, life expectancy is 73 years. So, you know, you've got a difference there of 15 years across 14 miles. And we have to ask, well, why is that? What is it about place and where you happen to be born that affects the health trajectory of your entire life?
All right, so that's like really clear. Like we can see Rich's kind of progression. We can see it, we can feel it. But what about for the both of you? Kind of what was the thing that made you say, no, the connection for me and the issue that I want to focus on and really deal with is the issue of housing. So, Mayor? Don't get confused, because I know, because I'm like, Mayor? Mayor? Here, I'll do Mayor. Mayor. Okay, Mayor.
I think we've all had our aha moment where we realized that the importance of housing first. I mean, that there's compelling humanitarian reasons to want to focus on housing first, but there's also, for those of us who have to convince the cold-hearted bastards in our organization that have control over the money, that there's financial reasons for having a housing first model as well. And as Rich described a moment ago, I mean, in my own city, you can go by zip codes, and there's a dramatic change in life expectancy. We very much got a tale of two cities, a very affluent city and a city where my school superintendent very recently told me poverty is doing very well in Mesa, Arizona. Absolutely, when you talk about social determinants of health, housing has got to be at the top of the list. And local governments play such a critical role in that. We are the funders and the regulators and the administrators. We are all of the great philanthropic money and federal government money that is in play typically runs through our organizations before it gets into the hands of those who need it.
So when Rich said that, you know, I think we're all gonna have this image now of an x-ray where we can see the chips of paint in a child's belly. And that's such a visceral kind of reaction. Do you remember when you kind of had this moment where you were like, wait a second, the issue of housing, and it may have been when you were 8 or 15.
No, I'm ashamed to say it was since I've become the mayor. It was about 4 or 5 years ago when we were cutting the ribbon on a wonderful brand new affordable housing project that the city had played a critical role in. And it was a wonderful partnership with our city where we were working with a great social service organization that was providing wraparound services, Head Start and financial counseling and after school programs. And I realized that this was going to have a significant impact in my community, that there's nothing more important that we could do as a community than exactly what we were doing that day. So that was my moment.
Okay, so former mayor, Shirley. Okay, Shirley. All right, Shirley. So when we met and you were mayor, I was actually interviewing you because at that time, I don't know the data now, I assume it's probably about the same. Atlanta was the center of child sex trafficking. The Atlanta airport is actually one of the main reasons why. So we were interviewing the mayor because this mayor had been very public about kind of taking that on as an issue and had put out a billboard.
The billboard campaign.
A billboard that said, Dear John. It was Dear John. And so that's how we met. So then we didn't see each other. By the way, we went to several, Atlanta has more strip clubs per square mile than Las Vegas. And so we went to a couple. It was strange. But now, you know, you've left the mayorship and you have focused wholeheartedly on this. So Shirley, what was that moment, the aha moment, where you're like, no, it's not about this, it's not about this, it's about housing?
So I worked for two mayors, Andrew Young and Maynard Jackson, and became very familiar with various neighborhoods in the city through that work. And there were some neighborhoods that were just always had problems. And they tended to be the communities, and this would be in the 1970s, 1980s. And they were communities where there was a concentration of poverty, low-income housing, housing of last resort. It didn't dawn on me then that housing was the pivotal issue, but we knew there were multiple issues and housing was one of them. On the beginning of the month, when in those days there were welfare checks that were coming out, we'd have to send police officers to these communities so that they would not be preyed upon by people who knew that they had been accepted, gotten these checks. So it became really clear that when you start looking at land use planning, when you look at who has access to transportation, et cetera, these enclaves or this concentration of poverty, and the most visible sign of that is bad housing. I mean, no one has to give you a sign. You go into the neighborhood and you see it for yourself. Vacant lots, rodents, trash, broken windows, vacant buildings. It becomes very clear. So it is, in some ways, what the mayor said. It's one of those issues that if you were trying to build consensus, you're able to take people to the place and say, look for yourself. So my goal over the years has been to see if there was a way we could develop a model where you'd go into a community and you would not know the socioeconomic level of the people who live there by yourself. In other words, you don't need a map, you don't need a tour guide. And one of the ways to start that work is with housing and the association between mental health. But my aha moment, and I know I'm too long, the aha moment was when we started a school and the second meeting of this charter school board, which I chaired the ward, problem was presented to us that a kindergartner had repeatedly come to school and thrown a chair at his teacher. And the teacher was very concerned, obviously, because what is your response to that? At home, it's one thing. At school, it might be slightly different. But the bottom line is, it became really clear that mental health was an issue too, that many young people, many adults, but in this case, many children are going to school with mental health challenges, and some of that comes from where they live, how they live, the opportunities they see.
And so one of the insidious things, right, we're all living through a period of time, actively, where we're living through dehumanization, right? Communities, people are being dehumanized, we're experiencing it. And so as you were saying that, Shirley, I was thinking about how when people who don't live in those communities may rarely, which is a problem, drive through them, and they look and they see what you described, the broken windows, the trash, the houses that are falling, and they say, well, these are people who clearly don't care about themselves.
Exactly.
Right, they're less than, they like to live. They created that, as opposed to the another conversation, which is, why is this community abandoned? Why is there no help? Why can't they fix it up, et cetera, et cetera? But I'm just trying to make people understand how insidious it is that we begin to think, well, oh, it must be okay.
Or sometimes you will hear from philanthropists, from people who are generous donors, well, I gave money to an after-school program, or I helped with holiday gifts, or I contribute at wherever I contribute. I mean, my experience over a couple decades now is that these point solutions will not get you where you want to go. And programs alone will not solve the problem, which is why I'm on this panel with housing.
So Rich, when she just said, you know, point solutions are not, and you started, Shay. So what do you, because we wanted to talk about structural issues here. So
if you don't understand what led to the situation that's there, then you end up thinking about, okay, let's provide charity. Let's provide services to help these people who are in these dire straits. But if you understand the history of housing in America and how America was deliberately segregated through housing policies, policies of structural racism, and if you're not able to talk about that, you're never going to reach the solutions that you need to see. If you look at zoning policies and what areas were allowed multifamily dwellings and what were not, it was based on race. If you look at who was given the opportunity to buy homes, you know, in America, we accumulate wealth in large part through owning a home. And who in America was given that opportunity? It was not people of color. They were not given mortgages. They were not allowed to move to suburbia.
Because they weren't seen as trustworthy. They weren't seen as, I mean, all of these kind of insidious things, again, that then become a part of how we manage an institution like banking.
Yeah, and not only that, when you look at these zoning policies that allow housing and industry to be together, you see issues where the quality of air in inner cities is worse than it is elsewhere. So you see worse asthma, you see chronic diseases, you see higher levels of stress, you don't see the integration of parks. There are these structural issues. You know, I was talking a week ago about the issue of health equity and how you ensure that everyone has a fair and just opportunity for health. And I said, yeah, you know, I just don't understand why the people from Trenton don't just move to Princeton. Right? I mean, and it got a similar laugh because the barriers are intense. I grew up in Princeton, New Jersey, and moved back 40 years later and have a different eye on it and understand that, you know, those initiatives to put in multifamily housing in Princeton that were opposed over and over again, the issues of putting in public transit in a place like Princeton that were opposed over and over again, were part of a system of structural racism that leads to where we are today. And if we're not talking about those fundamental problems, we're never gonna make progress on this.
And basically, I think what Rich is saying, and a lot of you already do this, right, but it's basically like shifting the lens. It's kind of like the focus of the lens of when you see something around housing, now you're gonna have a whole other series of questions that are going on in your mind. I mean, that's what we would love to leave you with, right, is when you're looking at something, you're just like, wait. So I'm in the process of writing a book, and I was writing about my experience of growing up in Chicago and driving from Hyde Park on the south side where I grew up to the north side, or any time that we would leave Hyde Park and just drive north. And we would drive through the housing projects. And as I was describing this, I realized these are facing Lake Michigan. Lake Michigan is beautiful. But these housing projects that were towers, you know, housing thousands of people, had the windows facing to the opposite side. They did not face the lake. And it was like a form of punishment, which gets me to the issue of mental health and how this kind of all. So Mesa is very different than the south side of Chicago, and they tore those towers down, I think, because they realized, like, oh my God, this is such a symbol of hate that we would build something that had no windows for people overlooking Lake Michigan. How does this play into Mesa? Not an urban city as big as Atlanta, or I don't know if it's the size of...
Well, we're surprisingly big. We're actually 500,000 people, second largest city in the Phoenix metro area, 35th largest city in the United States. So it's a great mix of urban, suburban, affluent, poverty. We got everything in Mesa, Arizona. And you were talking a moment ago about the lens, you know, focusing occasionally, and you'll see we can all see the problem, but I think we're all trying to get to what is the root cause, what can we, with people who have an opportunity to impact things like this, but how are we going to use the limited resources that we have? And mental health is the issue that keeps coming back over and over again. A few years ago, we changed the name of our fire department to the Mesa Fire and Medical Department to more accurately represent what actually they are doing. For the last couple of years, I've been asking a semi-serious question: should we not change the name of our police department to the Mesa Police and Mental Health Department? Because most of, when I go on a ride-along,
what's been the reaction?
Well, that's typical.
Well, but I think people are more just like, whoa, like, yeah.
Well,
as opposed to, whoa, like, no.
I'm not serious that we ought to do it, but I'm serious that we ought to be thinking that. I mean, because that really is the root cause of what's going on. And so when, as people that can impact things like infrastructure, where's the transportation going to go? Where are the parks going to go? Because I think, you know, Rich a moment ago talked about, raised the word stress. When you're in a low-income census tract area that has a lower life expectancy, why is that in comparison to their neighbor? I think it has to do with the stress that those folks are experiencing, the financial stress. It's not that they live in this house as opposed to that house. It's the environment that they're in. And when those of us who are in a position to help can direct transit, and the impact of a park is staggering. Most of us as adults, unless we have young children, we don't realize how valuable a playground is. We recently redid a city park and went crazy overboard on the playground, and it's become a huge attraction. People from miles away bring their children to this playground. And I was just shocked at how big a deal a playground can be. And the impact on the quality of life in our community by having this, you know, mother of all playgrounds has been dramatic.
In a way, what you're talking about, Mayor, some of you know this, of course, is toxic stress, right? And it is actually something that exists as a medical term. Toxic stress, which is stress that is not something that you just suddenly pick up, but it's actually generational. If your family was enslaved, if your family was trafficked, etc., there's generational toxic stress. And this filters into all of our lives in one way through housing. So there are a couple of TV shows that I want to bring up because I watch Netflix and things to chill out. I'm finally watching Jane the Virgin. I know I'm a little bit late to it, but I mean, I like know everybody in the cast and I'm just watching now. I love it. Anyway, so there's a show on Showtime called The Chi. I don't know if you've seen it. Lena Waithright created it. It's about an African-American community on the south side of Chicago. Mm-hmm. The central issue is housing. The central battle is around communities that are gentrifying on the south side, who's buying, who's selling, where gangs are involved, etc. I'm thinking about also Shameless, also takes place in Chicago. It's a show that the only reason why that family can have everything that goes on in the family is because they own the home. It is like the home is the central part of the whole ethos. And then I was thinking about gentrification and what my students who are, I just left teaching Chicago after 7 years, what they understand as gentrification, which is also very complex because they now talk about something called gentrificación. Have any of you heard that? Okay, so it's Latinos who have money who are moving into communities and seen as gentrifiers. Gentrificación. So it gets pretty complicated. But how, and then I guess just to throw it back at you, and then questions, by the way, so start thinking about your questions. The largest transfer of wealth outside of the African-American community, so wealth leaving the African-American community, was during the subprime mortgage mm-hmm. disaster. The amount, I don't think we understand the amount of wreckage that left. And it was because of this subprime mortgage issue, which basically was preying on people's, our idea that what we need to do is to buy our home. But they took advantage of that. How are we supposed to understand those connections? The subprime mortgage thing was not, I'm with Rich, like that's another form of structural racism. Anita Hill, in fact, before she kind of resurrected in this moment, was her whole focus was on black families losing everything they had because of the subprime mortgage. disasters. So, Rich, your thoughts as you're kind of making these connections.
It's just the latest in a history of housing being the big factor in where people end up and their trajectory. If you look at the rents that people pay, the poorest people in America pay, by square foot, it's much higher than the rents that are paid by people who have significant income. It's another way that people in poverty are preyed on. And if you look at people who have to spend a significant amount of their income on rent, on housing, 1 in 10 people in America spend 50% or more. When you're spending that kind of money on housing, you are not spending money buying fresh fruit and produce. You are not spending money on your child's education. You are not able to live in places that are close to your work. You are having this kind of stress that you were talking about, John, that impacts your health and your life. And the subprime predatory measures were not a one-off. It's just the latest in a long history of discrimination and structural racism.
So it's the word that I wrote down as you were talking, yikes, capitalism. Mm.
So can I get in here for a minute? So first of all, you know, as a former mayor, Atlanta is a great place. So let me just lay the foundation. It has its problems. We talked about that, right? Because
I loved living there.
Well, but it has its own problems. And one of the challenges is it's grown faster than its infrastructure. All of its infrastructure, not some of it. Its housing infrastructure, its water infrastructure, its transportation infrastructure, its social services infrastructure, its mental health system infrastructure. It has grown faster. So the question is here, how do you redirect a lot of this energy? And that is the issue that you've raised is a big one. I live in a community that was historically a white community. Blacks started moving into this community with great resistance from the white community. And now it was an all-black community for the 40 years I've been there. In recent years, now whites are moving back into this community. And the people who live there now are saying, well, why are they coming back? Okay? Well, they're coming back. Why? Because housing prices are reasonable. And because it's close to the infrastructure they need to live their lives. So it's been described by my neighbors as gentrification. Even though people are selling to them. And we've seen this over and over again. So what I would say is, we can spend a lot of time on that, and there's probably nothing that I can think of as mayor that I could do about that. So I tended not to worry about those things and try to focus on those I could. So our work says that if you look at the most impoverished, and I'm using that word just quickly, there's a lot of definitions of that. Impoverished neighborhoods that have not had investment, where people have been stuck, all the things that we've described, we believe that if you go in and you concentrate on a multidimensional level, with housing being crucial, so it's not just school reform and support for schools and community wellness and family wellness and access to jobs, but you have to do that over a sustained period of time. So we believe you have to have a not-for-profit that is actually working in that community to integrate all of those things so that over a period of a decade or two, this is not short-term work, you can stabilize a community where there will be a mix of income, but where the lowest income people will continue to be served and are able to work up the ladder, the socioeconomic ladder. That is not a popular concept. As mayor, I knew about this and did zero about it, because there was a lot of other stuff to do. And I can justify that I spent my time well. But perhaps I didn't spend my time so well. Because the income level, the poverty level of Atlanta has been in the 20s since the 1980s. And every mayor has said they wanted to do something about it, and every mayor has been unable to really crack it. I think it's because we're not looking at it the right way. The lens is they all knew the problem. The lens is wrong. We believe at Purpose Built that you have to focus on neighborhoods. Neighborhoods have schools, neighborhoods have parks, neighborhoods have access to transportation. Neighborhoods have community leaders who can help to protect the community in a way that the lowest income are served.
So basically a kind of organic. Go ahead, Richard.
Sure. I just want to ask you something, because when I visited Eastlake, I was blown away by what you've accomplished. But one of the things that struck me the most was that it wasn't this process of outsiders coming in and saying, here's how it's going to be done. It was the centrality of the community voice
yes.
in driving the direction. Could you just say a little bit about that process? Because it led to changes in the model.
It leads to changes in the model, and it also leads to cultural changes in the community that you're working in. So Eastlake started with a philanthropist, a resident leader, and a public official. And they battled each other in private meetings, and Carol has scars, Carol Naughton, my colleague, for being in those meetings to try to fashion a framework or a model for this mixed income housing. And we're not talking about home ownership, this is rental housing. Because the goal was to serve the lowest income. A pre-K, a birth to college and career, school, new model, and community wellness. Now at the time, 20 years ago, nobody talked about health. And we argued among ourselves whether we had any impact on health. We now know we did, thanks to scholars and other people who said, wait a second, folks, you're doing more than just building. but the community was very much a part of defining what that would be. There was, one example, quickly. There were two elementary schools within four blocks of each other. One served homeowners and working, kind of the working middle class. The other served only the public housing. So one was 100% public housing, the other was slightly more mixed income. The residents said, you know, one solution to a community problem of education that was not achieving for children was to say, move all of the children into one school four blocks away. The residents said, we deserve to have a great school in our community. 20 years later, the school that they helped to transform is now in the top five, moving from the last place school in the city district to the top five. The other school is closed because everyone wants to come into the community that they didn't want the children to come from 20 years later. So the residents actually drove that decision. And then they quickly said, we need to have early childhood education, and we need help with career, high school graduation to college, but also to career. They were very clear about that. And I sat in a meeting with them where they wanted uniforms. And they wanted uniforms to include shoes, because they did not want their children to be seen as different because of income and because of the lack of money. So residents drove both big and they also insisted on a 50-50 mix. 50% public housing. So, you know, there are dozens of examples. But the philanthropist and the government official would not have come up with those initiatives.
And I guess before, and by the way, so if you have a question, raise your hand. Do we have a microphone?
What? What? I know, we gotta be quiet.
Okay, all right, forget that. All right, so what, do we have a microphone? Okay, so here's what we're gonna do. Here's what we're gonna do. Come here. And we've got, so on this side, we've got 1, 2, 3, 4. Can you guys just really quickly ask your questions? Just give them the mic, and she's gonna ask her question, then pass it over here. Really quick, we'll get these four questions, and then we'll answer and debate, and then we'll come on this side and do a bunch. So just super quick.
My name is Emily Fitz, and I work at the Diatribe Foundation, which is a diabetes nonprofit. And so I live and work in San Francisco, where there's some of the most extreme homelessness in the country and also some of the most extreme wealth in the country coming from Silicon Valley. And there's this big tension around the question, what is the responsibility of companies that are contributing to things like gentrification and the exponentially increasing wealth gap in communities? And I'd love your take on that tension and that
Great,
question.
Thank you. Next question over here.
We gotta remember them, huh?
I'm writing them down.
Perfect. Hi, my name is Nihal. I'm co-founder of the Youth Movement Against Alzheimer's. Really interested in intergenerational housing, but my question is perhaps an issue that I find even more pressing, is with the oncoming climate change, how do we ensure that the communities are still insurable, especially in areas where we're seeing increases in hurricanes and my home state of California increases in fires?
Thank you.
Buenos días, mi nombre es Lourdes Rodriguez, and I serve as associate professor in the Department of Population Health at UT Austin in the medical school. My question is about the profit margin on housing. So we think of housing as investment as opposed to housing as shelter. And while I love and cannot wait to have purpose-built communities come to Austin, how do we encourage real estate overall to, instead of thinking, I will only go into a deal if I can make 25% profit, to think like supermarkets. If you can get 7 to 8% on your produce department, you do a little dance, right? So profit margins on housing.
I.e. capitalism. One last over here.
My name is Jonathan Yellowhair. I'm actually from Arizona and live in Atlanta, Georgia. So
there you go.
So my question
take a picture
was,
after. Okay.
Yeah. So it'd be some good references. But so with my question is more for Shirley. Recently, I met with some people who were doing work in housing development in Auburn Avenue, and like through the churches, you know, Ebenezer and Big Bethel and everything. So I was wondering if you could speak more to that, because when I went and visited these housing aspects, it was incredible to see the work that's being done. And I'm wondering, you know, what that may look like on a bigger scale for Atlanta in general. You know, places like People's Town where I work in Lakewood. So that's all I had.
Okay, a question to the panel. Do you want me to get all of these questions and then we? Or I know it's a lot, but I also feel like just hearing the questions is really interesting. So do you want to answer this? But that might take us to like, so at least this way we could hear them.
That's great.
Are you okay with that?
Sure.
Whatever you think. I think we're going to run out of time. I'm picking up a couple of general themes, though, that I think we could maybe synthesize some of these questions into one or two.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. All right, so let's just go. Go ahead.
Rachel Jones, and I'll be moderating the Living Wage Buys Health panel tomorrow. But I just came from the Reproductive Health panel with Dr. Liana Nguyen, and I think one of the reasons she is such an effective, powerful spokesperson for this issue is that she has lived the experience of many of the women that she works with, and she has a broader context. So my question for you would be, until we have more policymakers who have lived in the kind of housing that they're talking about, or understand it from that level, are we still going to be almost working at cross purposes?
Good afternoon. My name is Justin Smith. I'm a recent graduate of Emory University Rollins School of Public Health. I'm also from Atlanta. Grew up at Eastlake, so.
All right.
My question is, as concerned citizens who may not necessarily live and work in housing all the time, what types of municipal policies should we be advocating for our cities to adopt in order to promote affordable housing?
Thank you. My name's Kate. I'm with Eaton Senior Communities. We're a low-income housing provider in Denver. And I'm curious what you guys think are the most promising financing structures to develop more affordable housing with public and private partnerships. Okay.
And I guess just finally, okay,
I'm Larry Wolk, Chief Medical Officer at The Wonderful Company. If we're going to use healthcare dollars to spend on housing to improve health, is anybody developing a return on investment model with regard to how much should we spend versus how much then should we expect to save, or what kind of healthcare outcomes should we be measuring as a result of that spend?
Cool. All right, we're gonna stop there. There are a few more, and I'm sure there'll be more, but at least now we have a few minutes to kind of get your thoughts. Do you want me to repeat some of them?
I think we're going to run out of time. If you don't mind, I'll synthesize what I think I heard. And I think this goes back to Shirley's comment earlier. But I think mayors and local government have all understood for a long time that affordable housing is a very important problem. But what I'm starting to realize is that affordable housing is the problem in our communities. it's not, you know, a second tier or a third or fourth or fifth. It's got to be at the top of the list. And a lot of the questions that I just heard had to do kind of nuts and bolts. How do we finance? How do we get stuff out of the ground? How do we make things happen? And so I think affordable housing is the problem. Gentrification and capitalism, frankly, is also the problem, but it's also the solution. We talked earlier about, you know, the return on investment for affordable housing projects. The housing projects in my city that have been the most successful are those that we haven't looked at as real estate projects. When you look at these projects as real estate projects, they can pencil. And, you know, the more units you have, the better. So I'm not being critical of real estate projects. We need them. But the types of projects I was describing earlier, where we have wraparound services, where you partner, where you're not focused on how happy the investors are at the end of the day, but rather how we're allocating city resources in the most significant way to the most vulnerable populations. We have to have a little bit of a mind shift there. And we have to have partnerships. City governments, philanthropists, we cannot do this on our own. We have to be working with capitalists. And in my community, when we've done that successfully, they've been folks that know how to work with the communities. I'll quickly share a story of a very substandard living condition we had hidden on our main street, an aging trailer park that really was deplorable. I mean, you had electrical cords all over, water hoses attached to propane tanks. I mean, it was a huge catastrophe, you know, could have happened any time. So the city was forced, as the regulators, to come in and condemn this facility. Of course, then we were the problem. We were the bad folks that were trying to evict a population so that it could be turned over for profit making. What saved us in that situation, literally for a year, we had protesters in front of our city hall. Finally, we found a partner, Chicanos por la Causa, Chicanos for the Cause, that came in, and they had credibility in the community. We were able to turn it around, had a success story in the end. So we're going to have to change our ideas of elevating this to the top of the list and finding partners to work with our organizations to make it happen.
Shirley, and then we'll just give you the final word.
Well, I mean, land use, you've got to pay attention to land use. I mean, in metropolitan Atlanta, there are jurisdictions that require an acre of land to build a new house, or a half an acre or a quarter of an acre. We're not going to get there that way. I mean, we're going to have to look at density. If you can do inclusionary zoning, not every state allows it, but that's another way to include workforce housing at least, but also public land, the use of public land. The city of Atlanta, through its housing authority, which I suspect is the same in other cities, has hundreds of acres of land, and they're sitting on it. So keeping the land cost low by using public land is another way to address the issues of housing. The NIMBY happens in every community. It happens in a low-income community, middle-income community, luxurious community. So somehow or another, we have to address that and not be afraid of the shouting masses and the protesters, because people are going to complain if you are bringing anyone that they believe is undesirable. And that is not always race. Sometimes it's income, sometimes it's ethnicity. It can be a lot of things. So, I mean, those are some of the things I'd tack on to what the mayor said.
Yeah, it's wonderful to hear all the energy in the room, so much expertise in the room. And I hope people come away from this with some sense of optimism, that there's movement. Some of the things, just to touch on a few things, it is so incredibly important that community voice, lived experience, is driving the changes that we want to see. One of the programs we have, one of our change leadership programs, is the Health Policy Scholars. And the focus of that is to try and bring into the policy conversation groups that have been marginalized, that haven't been able to participate. And so it supports individuals from minority communities, individuals who are first in family to go to school, who are in doctoral programs, to give them the policy chops to be able to participate in conversation. The question about the role of industry in working to solve this, it's really important, and we're seeing some models where businesses, healthcare systems are taking on a role as anchors within their community and are looking at investing in community housing through all kinds of mixed finance models as good for business. It's a way to provide
a community in which people want to live. It provides housing for their workers across the income spectrum. And that's incredibly exciting. And then there was a question over here I wanted to hit, but I forgot what that one was.
Return on investment, financial structures, municipal policies, lived experience, profit margins, climate change responsibility.
Gone.
Let's
just a little on financing structure. So there's all kinds of interesting work going on in philanthropy, looking at program-related investments, ways that philanthropy can work with the private sector, can work with communities to provide things like loan guarantees to increase the willingness of private capital to come in and do these kind of developments. But when these things happen, it's so important that some of the experiences like we're hearing here that involve community voice in the direction of that change are part of it. Otherwise, you're going to see these situations where you're seeing displacement of community, you're seeing loss of power and voice, and you're not going to see the kind of long-term change that we want to see.
But I mean, it's not unreasonable to think government can't contribute to it.
Yeah.
I mean, this, you know, I my common answer to people who the city of Atlanta.
But right now?
No, local government.
Okay.
And state government. Local government and state government. I mean, Atlanta would never have built the airport waiting for the federal government to fund it. We decided 75 years ago that we were going to do that, and we have invested billions of dollars. We have to decide that we are going to do something about these other things.
Can I say amen to that too? Because it's shocking the amount of money that runs through local government. My city of 500,000 people, we allocate between federal and general fund monies to our nonprofit organizations over $6 million a year. And that's how these projects are getting built. They'll go out and have a great fundraiser and raise hundreds of thousands of dollars, and they match that with the millions of dollars that I can bring to the table, and that's how these things get done. So for those in the room who want to get things done, you need to be very good friends with the mayors and the city councilmen in your communities.
And
then
counting?
The county officials.
Okay, so we have like 2.5 minutes left, but who's counting? I want each of you to just give me, really short, your dream-o-vision. Like, we can't do it all. But if there was one thing that you're like, oh my God, I really want to see this one thing, or I want to make sure this one thing happens. Because this is a dream-o-vision. It's a dream-o-exercise. So
I want to see comprehensive, holistic community development as the model.
Wraparound services, affordable housing in the underserved parts of my community. We have some county islands, some folks, some places that are just beyond third world poverty, and affordable housing, like I say, is the problem.
Rich, take us out.
I want us to change how people think about health in America. That health is not just about having access to high quality, comprehensive, affordable health care, but health is about housing, it's about jobs, it's about education, it's about community, it's about removing barriers from things like structural racism. That's all about health. And if we just keep talking about health as access to health care, we're not going to be a healthier nation.
Amen.
Thank you. Richard Besser, Shirley Franklin, and John Giles. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Thank you for being here.
No,
it's
fine.
Have a great rest of your day. Drink lots of water.
This is Aspen Public Radio, and you've been listening to a rebroadcast from the Spotlight Health Conference at the Aspen Institute. You can find this discussion in full later today on our website, aspenpublicradio.org. Support for this broadcast of the Ideas Festival comes from Obermeyer Wood Investment Counsel, an independent investment advisor committed to helping clients navigate life's financial decisions. Learn more about the firm's team and approach at obermeyerwood.com. Support for Aspen Public Radio comes from Pitkin County Senior Center, hosting a summer day soiree with entertainment, fitness class demos, food samples, refreshments, and more, plus info on a range of community programs and services, tomorrow from 10 to 2, more at 920-5432. And from Alpine Bank, member FDIC, committed to giving back to the communities where they work, play, and pitch in with their neighbors to improve the places where they live. Alpine Bank, an independent, locally managed community bank. Learn more at alpinebank.com. This is Aspen Public Radio, your news, your music, your station. We now join All Things Considered.